This translation by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki. Okay, so it goes. Sri Sukadev Goswami continued. Thereafter, because of his advanced position in devotional life, Maharaj Ambrisha, who no longer desired to live with material things, retired from active family life. He divided his property among his sons, who were equally as qualified as he himself, took the order of Vanaprastha and went to the forest to concentrate his mind fully upon Lord Vasudev. Here's a purport. As a pure devotee, Maharaj Amrish was liberated in any condition of life because, as enunciated by Srila Rupa Goswami, a devotee is always liberated. Ihas yasya harir dasya kamana manasa gira nikilasu api avasthastu jivan mukta sa uchyate. In Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Srila Rupa Goswami thus instructs that if one's only desire is service to the Lord, he is liberated in any condition of life. Maharaj Amrish was undoubtedly liberated in any condition, but as an ideal king, he accepted the Vanaprastha order of retirement from family life. It is essential for one to renounce family responsibilities and fully concentrate on the lotus feet of Vasudev. Therefore, Maharaj Amrish divided the kingdom amongst his sons and retired from family life. Om Jnana Trimandascha Kananjana Shalakaya Chakshurum Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatam Vitam Tam Sajivam Savaitam Savadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Sagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha. He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagadpate Gopisha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namastute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrinda Vaneshwari Vishe Panusute Devi Pranamami Hari Priya Vanchakalpa Tirupascha Kripa Sindhu Avebacha Patitanam Pavnebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Kadadhara Shri Vasadi Gora Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So once again, the translation. Sri Sukadev Goswami continued. Thereafter, because of his advanced position in devotional life, Maharaj Amrish, who no longer desired to live with material things, retired from active family life. He divided the property amongst his sons, who were equally as qualified, and he himself took the order of Vanaprastha and went to the forest to concentrate his mind upon Lord Vasudev. Okay, Hare Krishna. So I'm a little nervous to give a class because there's so many exalted Vaishnavas in front of me, but I'll see this as an opportunity just to share whatever realizations I've actually come across with this. So I was thinking, before we even go into the purport and the translation, it would be nice to just see what the whole picture is, because sometimes we can get so focused in the verse itself that we get lost as to what the plot is all about. You know, so I'll just give a brief summary of what's been happening up till now at this point. So we're reading the ninth canto from the Bhagavatam, and it's a chapter which is actually entitled Durvasa Muni's Life Spared. That's what the chapter's called. So as mentioned, we're talking about Maharaj Amrish. He's a great Vaishnava, and when you read his pastime, there's so many lessons we can actually draw from this. It's mentioned, actually, Maharaj Amrisha actually comes from the dynasty of Vaivastvata Manu. From that dynasty, there's a great king called Nabhaga. Right? There's a king called Nabhaga. So the king Nambhaga once actually decided that he wanted to actually live a life long of celibacy. So he wanted to become a brahmachari. So he became a brahmachari, and Nambhaga had many brothers. And his brothers then, they thought that since Nambhaga has actually become a brahmachari, so let's divide our father's kingdom into amongst us, but not give anything to him. You know, because he was a lifelong brahmachari, so why does he need all of this wealth? Then one day after some time, Nambhaga actually comes back, and then he actually asks for his share of his father's kingdom. And the brother says, well, you know, your share of the father's kingdom is our father himself. That's your inheritance. So then Nambhaga goes to his father, you know, and he says, oh, father, my brother said that they've divided all your property, and they said, my inheritance is you. So Nabaga's father then actually says that, don't be cheated by such cheap words, you know. And then he gave him a specific instruction. He goes, the descendants of Angira, they're performing a sacrifice. And he goes, even though the descendants of Angira are actually very intelligent, he's mentioned that on the sixth day of the sacrifice, they're actually going to commit a mistake. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you these two mantras, and if you actually tell them and recite these two mantras, it will actually nullify the mistake, and the sacrifice will actually become more successful. So then his father, Nabaga's father, actually gave him the mantra, and then he goes to the arena where the sacrifice was happening. On the sixth day, of course, the descendants made the mistake, you know, of not chanting the mantras properly. And in return, he actually recited these two mantras, and hence the mistake was nullified. The descendants of Angira were very happy, you know, and they wanted to reward him with something. So all the wealth that was accumulated for the sacrifice that they got, they actually offered it back to King Nambhaga, you know. So he was entitled to all this wealth, a lot of wealth, you know. And so they were very grateful, you know, the sacrifice was very successful. They gave him the wealth, and then the descendants of Angira departed for the heavenly planets. At this moment, from the northern side, that's what the Bhagavatam explains, so there's a black complex personality comes and approaches Nambhaga. And he goes, all this wealth that you have, it actually belongs to me. And Nambhaga then actually says, no, actually it doesn't, it actually belongs to me. The descendants of Angira actually gave it to me. So then there was a bit of a conflict, and they were debating, and then this personality, the black complex personality that the Bhagavatam describes, he actually recommends, let's go to your father, he says to Nambhaga, and let's actually solve this dispute that we're having. So both of the personalities then go to Nabaga's father, and they actually present their arguments. And Nabaga's father actually says, you know what? What the black complexion personality is saying is true. He goes, all the wealth that Nambhaga accumulated is actually entitled for Lord Shiva, and therefore you should give it to Lord Shiva. Nambhaga, being a very obedient son, he actually, you know, went to Lord Shiva, offered his obeisance, offered prayers, and he actually gave all the wealth away very easy, very detached. Lord Shiva then spoke to Nambhaga, and he said that I'm very pleased by your prayers and your offering, you know. Yes, you're right that this offering actually belongs to me, but because you're such an obedient son of your father and you listen to your father, I'm actually going to give all this wealth back to you, you know. So therefore, Nambhaga actually got all the wealth back, and it was a lot of wealth. It's mentioned it is actually the son of this Nambhaga was actually Maharaj Amrish. Amrish Maharaj was the son of Nambhaga, you know. So this is where Amrish Maharaj comes. And from the very beginning, Amrish Maharaj was actually very wealthy. It says that he was actually ruling the entire earth, including the seven islands. You know, we hear the seven islands all the time. When you think, what's the seven islands? And then just this morning it clocked onto me, actually the seven island represents the seven continents we have, you know. So then hence means he ruled the whole earth, which makes sense, you know. So he actually had a lot of wealth, you know. He was a very powerful personality, you know, and he was a very exalted personality. But, you know, the quality of Amrish Maharaj was that he was very detached. You know, for him, he wasn't disturbed by material things. You know, he saw material things as, you know, something that you have in dreams, and then it gets destroyed. You know, so he was very detached like that. You know, the entire world, he saw it as a stone, basically. That's the description the Bhagavatam is actually giving. And, you know, he was very attached to serving the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Many times they say, actually, we should engage in devotional service 24 hours a day. And that's like, how does that work? But actually, in the Bhagavatam, this section is actually explained how Maharaj Amrisha actually engaged in devotional service 24 hours a day. And he's mentioned that every single aspect that belonged to him, he utilized it in Krishna service. So he goes that he used his mind in Krishna service. How do you think he used his mind in Krishna service? Remembering Krishna. So it's mentioned, Bhagavatam mentioned that he was meditating upon the Lord all the time. He also used his words for in Krishna's service. How do you think he did that? What was that? Glorifying Krishna, exactly, and his qualities and pastimes. How did he utilize his hands? Cleaning the temple. Gundicha Mahajan, right? So it's mentioned that he used his hands to clean the temples. His ears? Hearing Krishna Katha? Yeah. It's mentioned his eyes? Seeing the form of the deities. And then touch. How did he use the sense of his touch? Embracing the devotees. Thank you. Nose? Smelling the? Yeah, it's mentioned specifically that he used his nose to smell Tulsi Maharani, which is offered at the lotus feet of Krishna. And his tongue? Prasadam. Legs? Okay. Yeah, walking to the holy dams or the temple. His head? Bowing down, exactly. And his desires? Completely for the satisfaction of Krishna. You know, so it's nicely explained how Maharaj Amrish actually utilized everything he had in his service to Krishna 24 hours a day. It's also mentioned, actually, Maharaj Amrish was a very powerful leader. You know, when I was reading this purport, I'll go through it. One of the lessons I actually drew from it is a verse from the Bhagavad Gita. It's mentioned that whatever a great man does, common man follow, and whatever examples or standards he sets, everyone will actually follow in his footsteps. And it's mentioned because Maharaj Amrish was such a great exalted devotee and he was practicing what he was preaching, it's mentioned all of his subordinates or members of the citizens that he was ruling were actually also had the similar quality as Maharaj Amrish did. You know, it's mentioned all of the citizens at that time when he was ruling were actually attached to hearing Krishna Katha. They had no material desires and they were just completely absorbed in devotional service. And everyone was actually very happy being ruled under Maharaj Amrish like that. So he was a great leader, and it just shows that, you know, what a great man does, common man follow. And through this, you can see that. Then one day, Maharaj Amrish was actually observing an Ekadashi vow. You know, he's observing Ekadashi vow and Dwadasi for 1 year, along with his wife. And it was that during the Kartik month that the vow finished, and he was fasting for 3 days. And when he finished his fast, he actually bathed in the Yamuna, and then he did Maha Abhishek of the deities. So he did the whole Abhishek, you know. And at the same time, he gave away, the Bhagavatam mentions 60 crores of cows. Now, just in case if you're wondering, I had to figure out what 60 crore means. Jai Shri Shri Radha Gokul Nanda ki, Sita Ram Lakshman Hanuman ki, Gaur Nitai ki, Jai. 60 crore cows is basically 600 million cows he gave away in charity to brahmanas. That's a lot of cows. Imagine we having in Bhaktivedanta Manor. I don't think they have a problem about, you know, with the law that every cow should have a specific, you know, area for pasturing, you know, a pasturing ground. So it's mentioned that 600 million cows he gave away. Each of the cows had gold-plated horns and the hooves were actually silver-plated. So he was, as you can see, very wealthy. He fed all the brahmanas. And when they were fully satisfied, he was prepared to actually break his Ekadashi fast. You know, and just as he was about to do that, the great sage Durasa Muni comes along. You know, and so Amrish Maharaj then actually welcomes Durasa Muni and he actually worships him with different paraphernalias and he actually says, please take some prasadam. Durasa Muni happily agreed, but he goes, I have to actually go and perform my ritualistic activities. So then he actually goes to the Yamuna and he actually bathes in Yamuna, and he starts meditating on the impersonal Brahman, is mentioned. And in this meditation, it took a very long time for him to actually do the meditation. And in the process, what happened was the Maharaj Amrish was getting quite worried because the muhurta for breaking the fast was approaching. There's only one muhurta left. So he had to break his fast. So he actually goes to all the other brahmanas seeking the advice that, look, here's a situation, I need to break fast. And only on the advice of the brahmanas, he decides to break the fast. And hence, what does he do? He takes just, he drinks water. In the Bhagavatam's mentioned, by just drinking water is considered breaking the fast and not breaking the fast. Like that. And then he started, when he drank water, he's still waiting for Durvasamuni, and he started meditating upon Lord Krishna within his heart. At this point, Durvasamuni comes, and by his mystic abilities, he could actually sense that this personality, Maharaj Amrish, has actually broken his fast. Durvasamuni was hungry, and he felt neglected, and hence he just started saying all these abusive language stuff to Durvasamuni, sorry, to Maharaj Amrish, and hence he becomes very furious. What does Durvasamuni do? He actually takes a lock of some hair from his head, and with his mystic ability, he actually creates a demon out of this. And then this demon starts chasing Maharaj Amrish to kill him. Maharaj Amrish was very detached and he was fully dependent on the Lord. So when the demon was attacking Maharaj Amrish, he was actually composed and just meditating on the Lord. And as the demon is approaching Maharaj Amrish, we hear, or we've read in the Bhagavatam, that actually Sudarshan Chakra comes and kills the demon. Durvasamuni then sees this, that his endeavor becomes futile, and hence he becomes very afraid because the Sudarshan Chakra is chasing after him. And it's mentioned now, Durvasamuni is running all around the world, everywhere, from every corner. He is mentioned, he goes into the caves running away from the Sudarshan Chakra, he goes within the ocean, and even still he's running everywhere. The Sudarshan Chakra is right behind him, touching him, and it's actually burning him alive, basically. And then finally, Durvasamuni decides to go to Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, and both of them actually says, look, you know, none of our powers can even compete with Lord Vishnu, you know. So the only person that can help you is actually Lord Vishnu. And so the interesting thing is, in the Bhagavatam mentions that Durvasamuni actually had the ability or the qualification to go to the Vaikuntha planets, because he actually goes to the Vaikuntha planets to actually petition at Lord Vishnu. So he goes to Lord Vishnu in the Vaikuntha Dham, and then even Lord Vishnu was actually helpless. He goes, you know what, I'm actually fully under the control of my pure devotees. So the only person that can save you is Durvasamuni. And therefore, Durvasamuni then realized the exalted position of Amrish Maharaj. And he goes to Amrish Maharaj, he actually grabs hold of his legs, Durvasamuni, and he offers all these prayers. And Amrish Maharaj felt very embarrassed at the situation, that a brahmana is actually holding his feet and offering all these prayers. And then he then prays to Sudarshan Chakra. He goes that, you know, he just glorifies Sudarshan Chakra, and he says that whatever pious activities I or any members of my family have done, please in exchange forgive this brahmana. You know, and then Sudarshan Chakra was very pleased, it went, and then Durvasamuni then was finally relieved from this attack. And you know, so there's exchange of glorification. And just to let you know, Durvasamuni was wandering around for 1 year. And at that point, Amrish Maharaj were just stayed in that one position, one place, waiting for him to come back. He didn't eat, or it says he just drank water for 1 year. He came back, he actually offers prasadam to Durvasamuni, and then Durvasamuni goes about his way. And Amrish Maharaj then realizes his exalted position is mentioned. But he goes, he gives all full credit to Krishna. He goes, only because of him such things actually happen. And then it comes to today's verse that after due course of time, Amrish Maharaj decided to actually give everything away to his family members, divided all his property, and then he actually decided to take vanapras, retire from family life, and just focus completely on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, like that. So we've got 10 minutes. So there's few lessons when I was reading this purport, there's few things that actually could, kind of struck out to me. You know, the one thing I actually stuck out to me was, it's mentioned Maharaj Amrish was liberated in any condition of life. Why? Because he was a pure devotee and he was liberated. So it's mentioned Rupa Goswami instructs that if one only desire service is to the Lord, he is liberated in any condition of life. Now this was quite striking, because any condition of life means even when they were suffering, Amrish Maharaj was liberated. He wasn't unaffected, you know. And so this is one thing I drew across, and I'm going to show you a little diagram that helps me to comprehend this concept. If maybe Shipra, if we could just... So this is something I did a little earlier. that I could show you. Like, whenever we talk about karma, why do bad things happen, there's this one powerful model that Nectar of Devotion actually presents, you know, and I always find this very intriguing. And even at universities, when we actually present karma, this is a very powerful model that we can show. So first of all, you know, we talk about miseries and we talk about suffering. So it's mentioned that what is the... Okay, maybe I shouldn't have... My question to you guys was going to be, what is the root cause of suffering? Now, obviously, you guys are reading the board so you can see. The root cause of suffering is mentioned is ignorance. Okay? That's what Nectar of Devotion mentions. Okay? So it says, everyone in this material world are suffering, right? But why are they suffering? And it's mentioned is actually ignorance. What do you think the ignorance is of? Yes, exactly. The biggest problem, the biggest illusion that people are under is the misidentification. They don't know who they are. So the illusion or the ignorance is of the fact of the true identity. In the material, when people think that we're this material body, what happens is the next step is that they'll start getting desires. As living entities, we all have desires. And therefore, when you think you're this body, you will start desiring on the bodily platform. So because of material, because of ignorance of our true identity, we start getting material desires. When you get material desires, the next step is, when there is a desire, it's going to turn into an action. So you perform an action. So according to Nectar of Devotion, materialistic action is known as papam, which means that you will get reaction in this world. So what happens is two things. When you perform an action, two things happen. First thing that happens is you actually accumulate something called a parabdha karma. Now, parabdha karma is something called unmanifested karma, which means that there is a reaction that is come to you, it's about to come to you, but it hasn't actually manifested yet. Okay, and a typical example that is mentioned is that when Dhritarashtra was actually, when after the war, all of his sons were killed, and he asked Krishna that why did all of my sons actually die in the battlefield? So then Krishna recited that actually Dhritarashtra, he was a hunter 50 lifetimes ago. And as a hunter, is mentioned, I vaguely remember, he was a hunter, he actually tried to shoot a male bird. But what happens is the male bird escaped, but he blinded the male bird. And because it escaped, Dhritarashtra became very angry, and he killed all the little 100 baby birds, you could say, of this male bird. And therefore, Krishna says, you're getting a reaction for now. Hence, you're blind, and 100 of your kids have died. So then Dhritarashtra Muni asked, then, but why did it take me 50 lifetimes for me to get this reaction? So Krishna goes, it actually took you 50 lifetimes to accumulate pious credit for you to actually even get sons like that. So for the 150 lifetime, he was accumulating unmanifested karma. And then when he got 100 sons, then he got manifested karma. You know? So when you have unmanifested karma reaction, what happens is there's something called kutam, which is your material proclivity that increases. Material proclivity means a tendency to desire material things also increases. So it's a vicious cycle, as you can see. Material desire means material action, which means unmanifested reaction, which means your proclivity increases, which means you desire more material things, more action, and eventually you will get material reaction. Then you will actually suffer the consequence. Does that make sense? You know? So it's mentioned, the first lesson I could draw was this lesson. This is a great statement. I find quite... amazing is that sometimes in life we are imprisoned by our circumstances, but we're actually liberated by our consciousness. Okay? It's mentioned that we're imprisoned by our circumstances, but liberated by our consciousness. So it's mentioned that sometimes materially we'll be in a situation where it seems we're struggling or we're suffering. But with transcendental knowledge, you have uplifted your consciousness. Therefore, these problems that we go through becomes very insignificant. And that's why this purport makes sense, that in all conditions of life, he was liberated. Earlier this summer, I was traveling with Chandramouli Maharaj, and we were doing this program. There's a July the 4th is like the National Independence Day for America. We were in Washington, D.C. And so we were having a parade, and there we were teaching japa meditation to people. And I heard a beautiful analogy to explain people how devotional service, one can actually overcome their suffering. You know, so in Washington, D.C., there's a building that looks like the White House, but it's called the Capitol. So I'd go to the people that we're teaching japa meditation to, and I say, if you stand in front of this big building, the Capitol, how big does the building look? And they say, oh, it looks humongous. And I say, when you're in a plane, how big does the building look then? And then they say the building will look very small. So then I said, similarly, it's mentioned that all our problems in life are compared to this big building, you know? And it's mentioned that when you actually, through meditation and through transcendental knowledge, you do it, your consciousness actually becomes uplifted. You actually raise your consciousness. And when your consciousness is actually raised, all the problems in life become very insignificant, just like the building looks so small from the plane above. You know, so transcendental knowledge is very powerful. It's mentioned, how do we actually become liberated in all situations? It's through wisdom like this, is it possible? So that's the first lesson I learned, that just by reading Srila Prabhupada's books, you get this wonderful transcendental knowledge where you can uplift your consciousness, and hence you can be liberated in every single aspect of your life, you know, and stay focused on the goal. The second one we already discussed, what a great man does, common man follow. You know, and we see from Amrish Maharaj that, you know, by through his example, he teaches us how we can constantly be engaged in service 24 hours a day. You know, and the third lesson was how to engage in 24 hours a day. As I mentioned, you know, all the different activities that we can use. And when I was preparing this class, I was just thinking that, you know, you can actually, it's quite possible to engage in Krishna's service 24 hours a day. You know, like through the mind, through the words, through hands, eyes, you know. And yes, just last 2 days ago, myself and Shiv Prabhu, we were in Cambridge. They had their freshers' fair. And I was just reflecting that if I wanted to think of Krishna 24 hours a day, I could have. You know, like yesterday, we went to freshers' fair. All the students were coming and we were trying to sign them up to the Krishna Consciousness Society. And it was a great experience, you know. And I was just thinking, how is so easy to engage all of these things in Krishna service? You know, I was just thinking in my mind, when I'm reflecting back, the mind is always thinking, how can I present this Krishna consciousness to the students in a way they can accept and hence they will sign up? So the mind is always constantly engaged. Words, well, you're actually talking to them. So how can you engage the thought process of your mind into words which can actually then go into their heart and then they actually become transformed? Hands, well, you're shaking their hands. No, but, we were staying in devotees' house, so we were cooking prasadam and stuff like that. So your hands are being engaged. Ears, your eyes, all of these things are being engaged. Even touch. Shiv Prabhu was a little bewildered, you know, because it's his first time. So sometimes I had to embrace him to just kind of keep him pacified. You know, so that was very effective as well. Nose, tongue. Tongue is a very powerful thing, you know. Like when we found out we had a table, on our right-hand side, it was the Islamic society. And on our left-hand side, it said the meth society. So I thought it was like some sort of drug society or something, you know. But then when I went there, I realized it's actually a Christian Methodist society. So it's a Christian group. And generally when you have like a society like this and you're trying to give Christian consciousness, it's like you can feel this heavy tension, you know. And me and she were like, oh, you know, this is going to be interesting, man. We're going to have some rockers, you know. So then luckily we had 2 packets of cookies. You know, and we thought, you know what, let's just soften their heart. So when Shiv went, first thing he did, he gave the bag of cookies to the Islamic society, and then he gave a bag of cookies to the Christian society. And after that, they were pacified. Because actually what it is, when we're doing the freshest fair, we can't stand in front of the tables. You have to stand behind. But you know, we're a little rebellious. We'll stand in front of them and try to grab everyone. Sometimes we'll block their table as well and stop them from signing people up. Because we gave them the prasadam, they were a little pacified, you know. So even the tongue was being utilized. Legs, head, and desires. Even desires are such a powerful thing. Just 2 stories I like to share. Yesterday, when we were in Cambridge, you know, it's amazing how Krishna consciousness is such a powerful thing. It's actually very universal. So I was at Freshers' Fair, and I see this one Chinese girl. She's a student. She comes up and starts searching our table. At that time, I was talking to someone. When I finished, I started talking to her, and I go, "Hey, how's it going?" And you know, my standard lines. I'll speak to her, and she goes, "I'm actually looking for the Bhagavad Gita." And I'm like, "You what?" You don't hear that at university, you know, because I haven't even pitched anything to her. And then I started getting to know her. She's basically from China, and she actually did some backpacking. She did some traveling, so she went to South America, to Peru, you know. And there she goes, "I actually stayed in one of your temples, and she just had an amazing experience." She goes, "You know, every day we would read the Bhagavad Gita, you know, we recite it, and it was very powerful, and I actually want the Bhagavad Gita." And the one time when somebody actually wants a Bhagavad Gita, you don't have it, you know, because it was in the bag, in the car and stuff. So we took her details and it was an incentive. If you really want it, then come to a society event, you know. So that was an interesting experience that people are actually looking for Krishna. It was a desire, you know, like that. So, and how to engage in 24 hours. So yeah, these were just a few lessons that I wanted to share. it was supposed to be a discussion point, so I was wondering maybe if we could get one lesson that maybe from the Prabhu's side and a lesson from Mataji's side that we can draw, so we can take all of this together and meditate during the day. Anybody? Any lessons?